From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Gail Harrison. For Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. The Federal Reserve cut short-term interest rates again yesterday for the 13th time since the beginning of 2001. It was a subtle reminder that in spite of the recent recovery, economic growth is falling short of expectations. And there may be more cuts on the horizon if a turnabout doesn't materialize soon. The hope is that the lowered rates will put some backbone in the shaky economy, which eventually may mean more money in your wallet. But until then, what's your investment strategy? Do you even have one? Tonight we're talking with some of the country's top financial advisors about the advice they're giving their clients and the advice they might give you if you were in their offices in Fairfax, Virginia, Miami, Florida, or New York. How worried are you about the economy, your stock portfolio, your 401k? Do you still feel empowered as an investor, or has the flagging economy destroyed your desire to buy and sell? Here's your chance to talk to the experts, whether you're sending out an investor SOS or have a success story to share. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me right now from New York is Gary Schatzky. He is a financial advisor and founder of Independent Financial Counselors, also chairman emeritus of the National Association of Personal Finance Advisors. Hi, Gary.
Hello.
Good to have you with us. And also on the line from Fairfax, Virginia, is Patty Houlihan, president and chief executive officer of Houlihan Financial Resource Group and past chair of the Certified Financial Planner Board and International Financial Planner Council. Hello, Patty.
Hi.
Clearly, we're going to have some good advice from you folks tonight. Let me start by asking, who are your clients and how comfortable or nervous are they these days, Patty?
Well, my clients are typical clients, actually. They are executives of corporations. I have school teachers. I have people that are both are working, both income family earners. And so they're concerned about the market, and they're concerned about their 401k plans. They are excited about interest rates going down if they're trying to buy a new home or refinance. But they're not excited about the interest that they're earning in their money market or their cash accounts.
So concerned but not panic-stricken.
Concerned but not panic-stricken. I think that would be true.
Okay, Gary, how about you?
It's really a broad range, much like Patty, from those individuals that are working to corporate executives, some entrepreneurs. It's a broad selection of cross-section, I guess, of America. I think certainly the last couple of years has instilled a real sense of fear in a lot of people, I mean, whether they're clients or they're not clients, and some concern about the market the last 3 or 4 years. And even with this short-term run-up that we've seen, a lot of people are hesitant to jump back in, certainly with the same enthusiasm they had years ago.
I agree with that, Gary. I'm seeing a lot of concern, a lot of fear, but also understanding. I spent a lot of time, and I know Gary, so I know he has done the same thing, educating clients so that they understood that this could happen. I talk a lot about reversion to the mean. I talk a lot about standard deviation, and the 90s couldn't continue, and that statistically, we were going to go back to the mean average. And oftentimes when we do that, we actually go down below. It overcorrects. And that's what we're seeing right now. And so having talked a great deal about the investment markets and how they do perform, I was trying to keep them from overreacting when this fear did set in. 3 plus years has been a long time to accept this correction, if you will.
You know, the key feature in the way Patty practices and I practice and comprehensive financial advisors around the country practice, the key feature is to take a look at the totality of someone's financial picture. You know, all too often, investors get sucked in to the money manager mold, where they're talking primarily about, hey, what do you want to make? How much do you want to make today? Do you want 30%, 40%? And it's really driven by hype. And when you take the approach that Patty talks about and the approach that comprehensive advisors take, you're looking at the broad cross-section of people's entire financial lives and trying to make sure that in totality you have realistic expectations, that you're investing consistent with your risk tolerance and your goals and your objectives, and you're doing what's right for you based on your knowledge, the advisor's knowledge, and the current economy.
Well, let's cut to the chase then. What are you telling them specifically to do right now, other than not panic?
Run for the hill.
Find that mattress.
You know, one of the things that I've been saying to clients is you've got to focus. I mentioned it a minute ago about interest rates. If I've got retirees, they have been very concerned about the dropping interest rate environment because they are living on some of that income. But what we've done in the past is we've made certain that we've kept enough in a liquid position that we didn't have to overreact as interest rates dropped. What I'm advising my clients right now is, again, looking at the yield curve. And Gary and I are absolutely the same in that we manage by goals and objectives. We don't manage based on rates of return. And so when I'm looking at if I'm trying to provide income right now, I'm not in a situation with clients where I didn't have a cushion so that I could weather these times. So the last thing I want a client to do right now is to chase yield. The yield curve doesn't warrant going out long term, and in order to get higher rates of return, higher yields, it's exactly common sense tells you you're going to take risk to do it. You're either going to go way out on the yield curve, which it doesn't even pay you to do that today, or you're going to go with something that is not of good quality, so you're taking risk that it could default, or you're chasing after returns that possibly have equity involvement, such as REITs. So I'm constantly saying, understand the underlying investment. Don't simply chase a rate of return.
And this is, you know, this is exactly what is happening, is that people now are willing to take different levels of risk when faced with the prospect of getting 1/2, 1, 1.5%. They're saying, well, if I got to roll the dice, I'm willing to do it. And it's one thing to say it and fully understand the risk, but what many people are doing is jumping into risk that they don't understand. But there's another big opportunity here with these declining rates. You know, people, you talk about debt, and debt is not very exciting to talk about, and it's not very, you know, it's not the kind of thing that you brag to your neighbor that you sheared, you know, you cut your debt down. But some of the best investments you can make right now are managing your debt, whether it be refinancing your debt, whether it be taking your investment money and paying down your debt. Very frequently you could find yourself saving 6, 7, 10, 15% guaranteed. You know, and it sounds like one of these late-night talk show guys saying, it's guaranteed. But the fact is, when you pay off credit card debt, when you pay off high-interest debt, you are guaranteed to never have to pay that debt again. And that's probably, for many people, the best investment they can make, particularly in this market.
That's a good point, I think, because it does seem ironic that given the current situation, borrowers are getting rewarded, savers are getting punished. You know, so for those of us who grew up with parents who were very conservative and who said you can never go wrong saving your money, well, you know, maybe not, Mom.
And on that same note, Gail, one of the things that I've been suggesting to people, if they're we're refinancing ourselves, silly. The thing that I want everyone to stop and look at is how far along are you in your mortgage? If you're far down that road, you're paying the most in principal now. So that may not be the answer to refinance. But if the answer is refinance, what I'm suggesting to people is just what Gary is saying, and that is continue paying the higher payment that you're used to. And then the excess is going to pay down the principal so that you are, in essence, guaranteeing yourself that you're not going to have to pay that mortgage as long as you thought you were. So a 30-year mortgage may shorten up to a 20-year mortgage by simply using that strategy.
Let's back up for just one second and take a kind of macro view of how this works, because I'm wondering what you have to say about the suggestion that the parts of the economy that are really buoyed by low rates are already doing so well, it's actually kind of hard to imagine them doing any better even with the latest cut.
Meaning the housing sector, Gail?
Exactly.
Well,
you know, a lot of people, if I can just jump in on this, a lot of people think the housing sector is, in fact, being completely supported by these low interest rates. I mean, we've been in many parts of the country, and certainly in the major metropolitan areas, a lot of exceptionally bright people have been looking for at least a substantial reversal of prices, if not a crushing reversal. And what you found is that these low interest rates have supported an otherwise exceptionally weak economy, where people's assets have been dissipated through the stock market decline. People's incomes have been reduced either because they're underemployed, they're not getting bonuses, or they're unemployed. And yet, miraculously, the housing markets have really held up exceptionally well. So I don't know whether it's going to continue the boom, but it's certainly supporting many of these markets, like housing, from really feeling what many would think should be very draconian effects of the economy.
Mm. And one of the concerns for me in the housing side is that what I'm seeing consumers, not clients necessarily, but consumers doing, is that they are taking on possibly a larger debt than they normally could do, and they're doing it by way of an ARM, a 5-in-1 or a 7-in-1. And my real concern in that situation is that they are going to find themselves out 5 years from now or 7 years from now not being able to service the debt that they then have as the rate adjusts. So that the housing sector, and we've seen this if we go back to the limited partnership days in the 1980s, where there was a lot of real estate interest because of the tax laws that accommodated it at that point. We saw a lot of dollars chasing after real estate. I'm starting to see that again because people want something that they can touch and feel. So money has come out of the stock market. They've not known what to do with it, and they're putting it into real estate. As the real estate values are going up, left to their own, typically investors that are not professional in it will buy high and sell low.
Patty, I want to jump in here because we promised our listeners that they'd have a chance to pose some questions to both you and Gary, so let's do that. Let's go to Susie, who's on the line from Falmouth, Massachusetts. Hi, Susie.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I just want to say I called in about a year ago and spoke to On Point then about what I was doing. On the 3rd of July a year ago, I sold all my stocks because I was pretty disgusted with the way things were going in the stock market. And up till then, I hadn't bought into the bubble at all. And every time something came along, a bond matured or something, I would just buy another high-quality bond, either U.S. Treasury or municipal bond or a CD. And, of course, the interest rates have gone down. I mean, as your bonds are called, you can't buy them back at a good amount. But I don't live extravagantly, and I can live off my income from bonds.
And so your question is, what do you do now?
Well, yeah, is there anything else I can do?
All right. Gary or Patty, which of you would like to jump in?
Well, you know, if you're talking about trying to create a fixed income portfolio or an exceptionally conservative portfolio, you have a limited number of options. You don't have none. Well, first of all, there are still higher CD rates. I mean, there are still some CD rates in the mid 3s to 4%, which, you know, we would have scoffed at just a couple of years ago. But you have to do some shopping for something like that. This is for a particularly risk-averse investor. To the extent that you have liquid money, there are plenty of banks in every market around the country that are offering promotional rates, that instead of 0.5%, they'll give you 2 or 2.25% for a period of 6 months or 9 months, much like we've heard about promotional rates in credit cards. And, you know, times like this require us to be a little more vigilant in trying to squeeze what we can out of the assets we have. Now, you've painted the picture that you really don't want to take any risk at all. And while I'm exceptionally cognizant of, you know, individual risk preference, I would say that for most people, you should have at least some of your money a little bit in the equity markets. I mean, the larger brokerage firms would probably be a little more dogmatic in saying, well, everyone should have X percent. But even the more risk-averse investor should have at least a toe or two into a diversified, I would have a preference for a no-load, a mutual fund to augment your otherwise very staid portfolio.
All right, Gary.
I agree with Gary, and just one more comment, too.
Real fast, we have to take a break.
If you're going into the equity market and you're risk-averse, look for something that pays a good dividend, that's a blue-chip stock. It's something that you understand. With the tax changes, the dividends are much more favorably taxed now.
Okay. Susie, thanks so much for the call. We're talking tonight with some of the country's top financial advisors about your investments. What's your strategy for saving when you need to buy a house or pay for college education or your retirement? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about what to do with your money. The Federal Reserve has lowered short-term interest rates to a 45-year low, but what does that mean for you? Tonight, we're talking with some of the country's top investment advisors, and this is your chance to ask them. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we are talking with Gary Schatzky from New York, financial advisor and founder of Independent Financial Counselors, and also with us is Patty Houlihan from Fairfax, Virginia. She is president and chief executive officer of Houlihan Financial Resource Group. And right now I'd like to bring another guest into the conversation. Joining us from Miami, Florida is Dina Katz, a certified financial planner and president of Ivanski, Brown & Katz. And she's the author of Taking Charge of Your Retirement. Welcome, Dina.
Thank you, Gail. Nice to be here.
Well, I appreciate your giving us your good advice. Let me ask the difference between what you are telling your 40-year-old clients, your 50-year-old clients, and your 60-year-old clients in terms of what their strategy should be right now.
You know, there isn't much difference. The fact is, if they belonged in the market yesterday, they belong in the market today, and they belong in the market tomorrow. And I think one of the things that people try to do is match their age to where they should be. And the fact is, needs and circumstances dictate what you need from the market or not being in the market, not your age.
And what's the state of mind of your clients?
Our clients are, they're fine. We do the same thing as Patty and Gary. We do a lot of educating. The fact is, nobody's really happy. The last couple of months, people have been a little happier, but we don't let people enjoy the happiness, frankly. We tell them, you know, don't spend the difference. We also believe that returns will go back to historical averages, and that means if you look at the 90s, we're in for some pretty low return environment going forward. And so it's a matter of putting it in perspective. The fact is, if you have a long period of time, and even if you're 70 years old, statistics are you probably have another 15 to 20 years, you belong in some equities, and you need to look long-term, not what happened yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of what happened yesterday, there was speculation that the Fed could have gone to a half-point cut. Why do you think it didn't, Gary?
Well, you know, it's certainly more cautious to take this sort of an incremental step. And they certainly have the ability. What they did is they kept in their back pocket the ability to cut further. I mean, there was some great concern that with the dramatic drops we've seen, you know, what does he still have to do? And this was the, many would say, the more prudent course to take it incrementally and to see if there is a pickup in the economy.
I agree with that, and I also think that this latest cut was more toward the small business people, trying to stimulate that piece of the economy, which is fairly large comparatively. And so I think they're, you know, holding back a little bit in case they need to jolt it a little more.
Consumers clearly are not the big winners from this rate cut, because you're not finding mortgage rates, to the contrary, actually went up. Only short-term rates were pressured down, and most consumers find themselves on the investing side of short-term rates as opposed to the borrowing side, with the mere exception of, you know, home equities, which probably will enjoy some rate reduction.
And you do have to wonder, with rates now where they haven't been since 1958, I mean, if this doesn't work, what other weapons does the Fed have in its arsenal? Patty?
Well, the Fed can start buying their Treasury bonds, their longer-term debt. I mean, that's what they've threatened that they would do, and I think that's what businesses are looking at. I agree with what Gary said, and I was very concerned that that there was a possibility that they would go 50 basis points, because I how much lower can we go? And I don't want us to be, I think the concern of deflation is there. Greenspan said it was a minor, but he felt that deflation was possibly a little bit greater risk than the return for inflation. So I would really hope that we can stabilize and get businesses back spending. That's what it's going to take. Businesses need to start spending so that they can start hiring, so that we can get a real change in this economic environment.
Well, let's bring one another of our listeners into the conversation now from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Steve's on the line. Hi, Steve. What's on your mind these days?
Hi, good evening. I'm calling because I'd like to hear the panelists' views on an article published in The Economist magazine 2 weeks ago that basically asserted that there was a housing bubble in America. And the reason was they equated the very low interest rates with also the very low inflation rate. And so everybody is saying, wow, the cost of money is so cheap, it's really cheap to buy a house now. What they're not factoring in, and the Economist pointed out this fallacy, is that because of the low inflation, the expensive home prices will be expensive not just for the short term but for the long term. And so when those fundamentals are factored in, perhaps that will cause some correction.
Dina, you want to take a try at that one?
Well, I happen to agree with that. I think it quite naturally people ran to the housing market because it was the last place for them to go. Things look really terrific when we're enjoying this low interest rate environment. The fact is, many people who shouldn't be buying houses are buying houses simply because they're excited about the low interest rate. And I think that they're buying more expensive homes than actually the homes are worth or that they can afford.
Gary, you know, bad strategy?
Yeah, I think there is, again, you know, in many of the markets, a housing bubble. You take a look at why has housing skyrocketed? Well, the one fundamental reason is the interest rates. But there's plenty of other reasons that are much more troubling. Real estate is not equities. Okay, so people are running to anything that isn't equities. Real estate is something you can touch. Well, at least it'll be here, whether it's gone up or down in value, at least I can touch it. And real estate's gone up in value. And that reinforces the concept that we are momentum investors. Technology rises, buy tech. Real estate rises, buy real estate. Something else falls, we'll buy something other than what's falling. And some people are buying real estate for their home for all the right reasons. This is the place I want to live for the next 15 or 20 years. But many people are not only buying real estate, but buying more real estate for a host of the wrong reasons. And that's what can lead to a bubble.
And I think one of the things that troubles me the most is that, at least in the market, when the market started to correct, people could sell it. They could get out. When real estate starts to correct, it's illiquid. And if you don't have a buyer, you can really be hurt. We saw that back in the 80s. We saw that with the SNL debacle. We've been there before. And I think Gary's absolutely right. It does matter where you are. Being in the Washington area, we have typically been insulated because we've got a lot of government here, and they do keep paying their employees. So, but depending on where you are and depending on the class of real estate that you're buying, if you're buying commercial real estate, you need to look at the occupancy levels. There are so many things that go into real estate. And again, I mentioned earlier real estate investment trust. People are buying those chasing after the yields, not looking at the underlying properties and not looking at the payout ratio, if you will, on those, the funds from operation and how much they're paying out. So I think that there is a great concern about real estate and the pricing that we're seeing right now. If we don't have jobs, we're not going to be able to continue to pay mortgages, even if they're at lower rates. If you've taken an ARM, when the ARM adjusts, people are going to be in serious trouble with debt. I'm really concerned about the debt that people are taking on.
Right.
Steve, what about you? Are you in the housing market now? Do you own real estate beyond perhaps your own house?
No, I don't. I don't own real estate now, and for personal reasons, I'm not in the market now, and I'm kind of glad because I know I'd be torn about, gee, do I buy now or do I not? So I'm glad to have my hand being pulled away right now. So.
All right.
Blame it on us.
Thanks so much for the call, Steve. Let's go to Rachel now, who is on the line from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Rachel.
Hi. Let me see. It's gone long stray from my original question. But I'm thinking that the people are not investing in the stock market anymore because they can't trust either financial advisors of any kind or the companies they might have interest in buying stocks in.
So, one of my favorite topics.
Okay, Gary.
We're going to all talk on top of each other now, Rachel.
All right. Well, let's start with Gary and then quickly get a comment from Patty and Dina as well then.
You know, I think, you know, when people talk about issues with Henry Blodgett supporting pumping up stocks like Yahoo, that's really the tip of the iceberg in terms of the problems that consumers face. Imagine the scenario. Henry Blodgett had part of his compensation driven by pumping up an individual stock to primarily sophisticated buyers who put a little piece of their money into Yahoo stock. Imagine the scenario that we have in this country where you have hundreds of thousands of advisors and literally millions of Americans who are getting 100% of their advice from folks who work on commission. And that's what I think a lot of consumers are having some concerns about. They're saying, my God, there are these inherent conflicts of interest, and we really need to get impartial advice. Now, this is not to say that commission people can't be brilliant and can't be honest and can't be have all of the attributes that you're looking for, but what people are now waking up to are, wait a minute, we would never allow a lawyer to have conflicts of interest like this. We would never allow a physician to have conflicts of interest like this. In fact, they'd be disbarred or lose their license if they did. And it's shaking the roots of people's confidence in the advisor community. And I think in many cases it's rightly so. And it's a good thing for people to be aware of the fact that you need expertise, you need impartiality, you need fiduciary duty, you know, like a loyalty to the client. And hopefully what the last couple of years has done is waken people up to the fact that they have to demand more from their advisor.
Well, Gary's prescription certainly sounds like it could work, but Patty, what do you think? Is it going to happen?
Well, I agree with what Gary has said, but I have to be I'm pragmatic. For many of the people that need advice, they can't afford to pay the higher fees, and they do need to go with another means of paying their advisor, which
fees as opposed to commissions.
As commission, that's correct. Mm-hmm. And I agree completely. There is an inherent conflict of interest. That's why it's ever so critical that you understand the credentials of the person with whom you choose to work. Do they have a code of ethics? Do they have standards of practice? How long have they been in practice? You know, get to know the person. Trust is the critical word. When I spoke for one of the town hall meetings with the SEC, I remember hearing some horror stories from people about some of the experiences that they had had. And the critical component was you had to find someone that you could trust. And trust is not just a gut feeling. It's backed on you've done your research. You wouldn't buy a stock without first researching the company. Why would you hire an advisor without first researching that advisor?
All right. Well, Dina, do you have a final thought on this point?
Well, I do, and I think the other focus we need to look at is the reporting that's being done for us as advisors. I mean, I'm not going to defend the advisor market. I think a lot of us were taken for a ride just like the investors. If we can't believe the research that we've done and we're getting false information, we're never going to be that good no matter how we make our living. So I think we're going to see a lot more of the SEC stepping in and the NASD and a lot more regulation so that we can in some way regain the public trust.
In fact, Dina, when I was serving on the first investor summit that the SEC had while Harvey Pitt was still there, that was one of my biggest concerns. There was a loud outcry that you need to dummy down the information. The literature, the legalese is, you know, far too much. We can't read 90 pages of something, and, you know, you just need to make it easier for us. And my argument to that was, prioritize it for the investor. You know, there are people that can do that. We could do that together with the SEC and with the regulatory
bodies. Investors aren't stupid.
They
investors
are not.
Are just
that is exactly right.
Not
and they,
knowledgeable in certain areas.
That's exactly
not
right.
Stupid.
Give
but
them you know the what, information.
What they do in the legal community is lawyers, by law, must avoid even the appearance of impropriety. That's what they call it. They say you must avoid even the appearance of impropriety. And that's designed to protect the public so that if a lawyer was ever involved in earning a commission on a transaction, they would be disbarred. In many respects, that protects the public without them having to get involved necessarily, although they're encouraged to, in every last nuance, knowing that the person who's giving them the advice is driven by that highest standard of code of ethics, which unfortunately doesn't apply in the financial advisor community. And that's something that hopefully over time, as the public begins to recognize it and they have, and as consumer press recognizes it and they have, they'll start demanding that level of loyalty.
All right, Rachel, thank you so much for the call. And panelists, let me explore a variation on that theme, because when we read reports about how the 400 wealthiest taxpayers in America are getting richer, even as their tax burden is going down, I mean, at some point, does the small investor begin to think, what is the use? You know, I can't win no matter what I do.
Well, that possibly, I mean, I think that's probably true. But, you know, what I think sometimes we lose sight of is that when you're isolating that segment, those are the ones that are hiring. Those are the ones that are, even though their tax burden is going down, hopefully some of that money is going to go back into getting the economy going.
It sounds like the Reagan trickle down to me.
Yeah, I can't buy into it, but I'm from New York. We'd be kicked out if I bought into it. You know, I mean, there certainly is an argument to be made that certainly the tax cut changes the last couple of years do create, you know, differing incentives, and whether it trickles down or not is what everyone tends to debate. But my wealthiest clients are even wealthier, courtesy of this, and that's because a large percentage of the tax reduction is falling to them.
But what about the smaller ones?
The smaller ones are not getting, you know, let's be clear here. The smaller ones are getting very, very modest reductions in their tax burden, and it is problematic. And this is what you hear on the Hill all the time. Some people call it class warfare. Others call it a straight ethical debate. Look, my average client ranges from upper middle to quite wealthy, but I think I have a sense of how this falls along the various barriers. Most of these changes are primarily helping the wealthier Americans.
But the point is, it doesn't mean that the investor gives up, the smaller investor.
Oh, absolutely.
The fact
not.
Is, you're receiving a little benefit. And the fact is, you need to look at where you need to go with your money. And that means you can't just stuff it in a mattress and walk away, because there is risk in stuffing it in a mattress as well. So you've got to be out there. You've got to be prudent about what you're doing, but perhaps not take the kinds of risks where you're going to make yourself rich, and be realistic about it. You're not going to make yourself rich by investing. You're going to make yourself rich by what you do for a living.
We're talking this hour about staying afloat in these uncertain economic times. What's your new strategy for saving? Are you back in the market or waiting it out? When will you feel safe to get back in? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about investment strategies for 2003. What are you doing with your stock portfolio, your 401k? Have you found a life raft yet, or are you still treading water? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking with Gary Schatzky from New York, financial advisor and founder of Independent Financial Counselors, Also with us from Fairfax, Virginia, is Patty Houlihan, President and Chief Executive Officer of Houlihan Financial Resource Group. And from Miami, Florida, Dina Katz, who is a certified financial planner and president of Evansky, Brown & Katz. We have lots of good folks on the line waiting to get the full benefit of your expertise. So let's go to Brookline, Massachusetts, and hear from Brett. Hi, Brett.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
When I first tuned into your program, I heard one of your panelists, I believe it was Patty, say that over time things revert to the mean. And I thought, like, oh, finally I'm going to hear from a reasonable analyst. But then I was disappointed to hear later she wasn't talking about reverting to the price-to-earnings mean. She was talking about reverting to the annual returns mean. In a nutshell, I think right now, by historical standards, the market is so grossly overpriced that I'm frankly amazed that anybody can recommend equities. So I'd be curious just to hear what
are you investing in, Brett?
Well, it's tough right now because, you know, bonds aren't a good deal and real estate's overpriced and equities are bad. Right now, I'm focusing on just capital preservation. I'm in commodities, primarily gold.
Brad, I'm glad that you perked up on the reversion to the mean. And it wasn't necessarily the return, though that was what I mentioned. Absolutely, you're right about that.
And hold on, Patty. Reversion to the mean, you've got to help me out with that one.
Okay.
Does that mean what goes up must come down?
Well, basically, if you think of a bell curve, if you go back to your statistics days, if you think of a bell curve, if you draw your line right down the middle of the bell curve, that's what we call the mean. And it can go down, the market goes down, the market goes up. PEs go down, PEs go up. We have what is
PEs,
known as
price earnings?
Price to earnings.
Okay.
Yes. And so what that says is, what is the price that I am willing to pay for $1 of earnings from this company? And when we look at the PE of the market, and I think that's what Brett is talking about, the PE of the market is still very much above its mean average. However, if you look at individual companies, the PE of all companies are not necessarily above that average. So I think that there are opportunities out there, but you've got to be very careful what you're looking for. If you're looking in that, Brett, maybe what you would want to do is to go with a mutual fund, if you don't want to pick individual securities, that is focusing on value, because typically what those funds do is they buy stocks of companies that they feel are low price to earnings, low PEs, and therefore because they are low PEs, it's a good value. You buy a low PE and it will go up according to exactly what I've said, the mean. So I think there are ways that you can get into the market, Brett, but you just have to be careful as you go.
All right, Brett, thanks very much for the call. Let's go now to Colma, Wisconsin. Robert's on the line. Hi, Robert.
Hello, yes. Hello to all of you. My question relates to the relationship between interest on savings and bank failure. In other words, low interest rates as we have now favor or disfavor banks as financial institutions?
All right. Gary, you want to take a stab at that?
You know, it can cut both ways, but very frequently what you'll find is that the banks tend to be relatively quick at lowering the rates on their deposit accounts and a little less nimble when it comes to lowering some of their lending rates. And there are plenty of exceptions out there. But some in the banking community are finding that their existing portfolios that they've inventoried, that they've held on to, are not getting refinanced at the rate that perhaps a prudent person would expect them to be. And they're finding that their profits are increasing. And so consequently, it's a net positive. At the same time, you're seeing low interest rates, as I had said earlier, come plummeting down, and there's still banks that are paying 2.5% or 2.25% on money market funds. And when you talk about bank failure, you should ask yourself, how long can that game go on? Because there were plenty of SNLs years ago that were doing much bigger mistakes than that one, but we're running into some serious trouble.
And I think, too, on the side of bank failures, you have to look at where the banks are lending. And I think that if you look there, you're finding that banks are very careful in how they're lending now. and they want credit-worthy investors if they're going to be lending, and we're seeing things like having to have so much down if you're buying real estate to protect the bank so that they're not ending up in the days that I mentioned earlier with limited partnerships where the value of the real estate plummeted and the actual amount of the loan or the mortgage outstanding on that property was more than the property was worth. That caused the S&L debacle, and that's where I think that we've learned a lot from that lesson.
And I would also caution that if banks are offering a higher money market rate, much higher than you can find elsewhere, they're doing that to attract business, and there may be a flag there. They're not in particularly good shape.
And you have to look at the underlying, and I think this is what Gary was saying as well, you have to look at the underlying investment pool. Why are they offering that, and is their money market generating that higher rate of return? Because if it is, that means their commercial paper or their repos or their short-term instruments that they're holding may have risk that you're not aware of.
All right. Thanks for the call, Robert. Let's go now to Pelham, New Hampshire, and hear from Peter. Hi, Peter.
Hi there. I've got a different take on all of this. I think it's a very uncertain time. I think the economy is very vulnerable to another terrorist attack or some other major world event. And I think putting your money in the market is a bad thing to do. I think your best thing you can do is build your assets as carefully, as quickly as you can. Get rid of your debt. If you're going to refinance your house, don't take out all the equity and buy more stuff. Leave the equity in the house or use it to pay off credit cards. Get rid of your debt. Don't raise your debt. Build your assets and sit quiet while you wait. And you can put your money in a bank or you can put it in a dividend-paying solid stock. You can go to Fidelity or Vanguard and buy guaranteed.
All right, Peter, we take your point. What about that, Dina? Conservative approach, to be sure.
Well, you have to understand, there is no riskless investment. There is nothing that you can put your money into that doesn't have some kind of risk. So not being in the market and, holding tight and putting your money somewhere is also costing you in the way of some opportunity, and which may very well affect your future. And what you need to weigh is, am I going to feel better sitting things out now? You know, would I be more comfortable being out of the market when it goes up than in the market when it goes down? So in order to get market returns, you have to be invested in the market, in any market, whether it's stock market, bond market, or anywhere else. So just sitting tight may be an appropriate thing for you to do at this moment in time. But it is not without a certain amount of risk.
And I think what all of us have been saying is that if we understand the goals and objectives of the client, the time frame and their risk tolerance, that's how we go into the stock market. We're not suggesting that you go into the stock market and day trade or come out, you know, with a time horizon of a month or two. For all of my clients, if they can't be there for 5 years, then I don't suggest the market is the right place to be. That's long-term money. And if we go out 5 years and look back, that what Dina has just said is absolutely the question. Are you going to be glad that you set it out 5 years from now?
Gary, I want to ask you one last big picture question, and that is about the overall psychology of this economy, because one of the frustrations that I'm hearing seems to be that it just isn't responding the way that some of the experts think that it should. You know, for months now, we've been hearing that any day now it's going to be getting better. And, you know, here we are still waiting.
Yeah, what you're pairing is not only an economic downturn, but an economic downturn right on the heels of this robust growth that we saw 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years ago. And there's no limit. You know, you can put whatever headlines you want out there. When people are underemployed, they're not getting bonuses that they were getting, they're not getting jobs, and money is tight, you have a lack of confidence, and that's what we're seeing. Now, this is happening, you know, at a time. Take a look at where we are now as opposed to where we were 20 years ago.
And if you can do that in about 15 seconds, I'd be grateful.
the key thing is people have to focus on their financial affairs. They have more at stake now in managing their future than they ever did. Pensions are disappearing. Social Security is uncertain. More of their investment and financial decisions are at their in their hands rather than their companies. And people really have to take stock of this and go forward and manage their affairs if they want a rosy future.
All right. Well, thank all three of you very much. Gary Schatzky, who joined us from New York, Patty Houlihan from Fairfax, Virginia, and Dina Katz from Miami, Florida. You can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, a look at yesterday's discovery of a nuclear program component in Iraq. This is On Point. It was the lead story on the news last night and made headlines in morning newspapers across the country. Evidence of nuclear program found in Iraq. The components were turned over to the CIA by an Iraqi scientist who said that he had buried them in his backyard 12 years ago. But today, the International Atomic Energy Agency said the Baghdad stash is not the smoking gun that would prove Iraq had a weapons of mass destruction program when the United States invaded. Jonathan Tucker is a former UN weapons inspector in Iraq. He is currently a senior fellow at the United States Institute of Peace. In this radio diary, he reflects on the significance of yesterday's discovery.
Well, it's significant, but it really doesn't relate very much to the controversy over whether there were active stocks of chemical or biological weapons or a nuclear program immediately before the recent Iraq war. These are components of centrifuges that would be used to refine weapons-grade uranium for a nuclear program that were buried 12 years ago in 1991 and have not been touched since. That indicates that 12 years ago, Saddam Hussein had the intention to reconstitute a nuclear weapons program at some time in the future, but did not have an ongoing nuclear program. Even with these components, Iraq was still very far from an active nuclear weapons program. These were just a few key components for a centrifuge that would be used to refine uranium, but literally hundreds, if not thousands, of centrifuges would first have to be built and then operated for a period of years in order to generate enough weapons-grade uranium to actually make a nuclear weapon. I think it is significant to the extent that it indicates the intention of the Iraqi regime to reconstitute its nuclear weapons program at some time in the future, probably when sanctions were lifted. The fact that these components and documents had been hidden, had been buried for 12 years, indicates that there may be similar key components and documents related to the chemical and biological warfare programs that have also been concealed in order to give Iraq what would be called a rapid breakout capability. That is, it's possible that Iraq did not have active stocks of chemical or biological agents, but rather had preserved key components and recipes for the production of these agents so that they could reconstitute their programs at some time in the future. What was perhaps most significant about this finding was that the information was provided by a weapons scientist who had been aware of this for 12 years and finally decided to come forward. This does indicate that there may be other cases of secret caches of weapons-related documents and components that may also be buried, and the only people who know their whereabouts would be the weapons scientists who either did the burying or were otherwise directly involved. And I think part of the problem is that there is such enormous uncertainty in Iraq today. It's not known whether Saddam Hussein is still alive, may still be at large, could conceivably return. So unless we give these former weapons scientists clear assurances that they will be protected, they will not be prosecuted for war crimes, they have very little incentive to come forward with information of this type.
Jonathan Tucker is a former weapons inspector in Iraq. He is currently a visiting senior fellow at the Institute of Peace in Washington. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.